This is Cross Defense, that unique program where we talk about apologetics for intellectual minds of all ages. I'm your host, Rod Zwanitzer. Today, we're going to talk about a best-selling movie, Walt Disney, great animation movie called Frozen. Maybe you've seen it, maybe you haven't. Our guest today to talk about this movie is Reverend Sam Schulteitz. He's a pastor in Southern California. Welcome back to Cross Defense, Sam.
Thank you, Rod. Great to be back on with you.
Probably a little bit warmer out in California than it is here in Missouri.
Yeah, I won't say what the temperature is today, but it's much warmer and nicer here. Yeah, we get spoiled, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, we feel frozen, so this is really going to work for the movie.
Perfect. It'll fit in well with the climate there.
Yeah. If you'd like to talk with Sam and myself about the movie Frozen, your questions or comments, please do so in the St. Louis area. Phone us at 314-821-0850, worldwide 800-730-2727, or email kfuo at kfuo.org. Sam, my wife and I went and watched this movie last week. We really liked it. The music was good. The animation was good. And I even saw some things in there that I thought might have a Christian apologetic usage in them. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. That was one of the things that actually surprised me about the movie. I expected the animation to be excellent. It was. It wasn't quite as computer graphically generated as a lot of some of the other, you know, recent animated movie cartoons, just to speak stylistically about it. So the animation had a different feel to it. Obviously, it was still more computer-generated than the old Disney classic ones that you watch with the hand-colored and painted artistry and the things there. But still, a lot of skill and artistry went into this new one, too. So the animation was great. The characters were, you know, wonderful. There was a lot of good humor. I just thought it would be a good family-friendly movie, which is why we took our little girl, 2.5-year-old daughter Zoe, to go see it too. And it hit on that mark altogether.
What did Zoe think of it?
Oh, she loved it.
She
was pretty much captivated the whole time. You know, 2-year-olds get a little antsy towards the end of the movie, which maybe she did, but for the most part, she was enjoying it. When the TV commercials come on now, they're promoting in the sing-along version that's re-released back in the theater, you can go and sing along the songs with it. So she'll start singing along with some of the songs now after, you know, we saw it about 2 months ago, maybe, whenever it was that it first came out. So she has a good memory. Kind of funny how those kids pick up things with music so quickly.
Yeah, and for a while, they are sponges, aren't they? They walk around the house and they can remember a lot of that, which should tell us when they come for Christian worship and they get some hymns, they can remember a lot of that stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I think much better than we adults do. We're impatient when it comes to learning new things like that, but they just love it.
Now, as I understand it, this is an adaptation of a Hans Christian Andersen tale called The Snow Queen.
Right, yeah. And it's not the first time that Disney's done this. They've done a lot of different Hans Christian Andersen fairy tales. Probably one of the most notable ones that they've readapted was The Little Mermaid, which, if you ever end up reading it, it's drastically different than the original fairy tale by Hans Christian Andersen is. This one, too, off The Snow Queen. And I think it actually ends up being a better movie. I didn't know it was based on The Snow Queen until the credits came through rolling in the theater. And I thought, oh, well, that sounds interesting. I have a collection of Hans Christian Andersen fairy tales at home. So I went home and read it it was short, but it took me a day or two to read it with time and everything. And I was kind of disappointed. The movie was a lot better, thankfully. Mm. You know, sometimes the movie ends up not being as good as the book, or at least just not the same.
Sure.
This was one where it was far better. I thought the movie made a better story.
Oh, great. Does the this new Disney animated version, do you think that it kind of spikes up the Christian potential for points of analogy with it?
Oh, I definitely think there's some really pretty glaring, and like I said, I think before, that it took me by surprise, but yet unexpected and glaring connections or glimpses of the gospel in this movie, something I didn't see coming, really. Again, I just went to see a good family-friendly film, and sometimes I know about things like that ahead of time. Oh, you should, somebody will tip me off and say, think about this in terms of the Christian faith or whatever when you're seeing the movie, you know, just in kind of a vague general way.
Yeah.
But nobody had done that for me with this movie, so I didn't really, I was blindsided in a good way by that. Because I think everybody in general should just keep their Lutheran antenna or their Lutheran radar up when they go to see any movie, whether they know there's going to be some kind of biblical reference to it or not. You should just be looking at it as a baptized Lutheran Christian, the way you would look at anything in the world, from a book or a conversation or something you read in the newspaper, whatever it may be. That's how you approach how you look and think and act in the world around you. So movies aren't really any different in that regard.
Sure. So you're, I think you're saying, Sam, that the new creations we are, as Paul says in Corinthians, we see all things anew. The old is gone, and we see ourselves, the world, even movies, through a different set of eyes, a different set of filters.
Yep, precisely. And I think kind of the apologetic or the glimpse of the gospel that we can get in a movie like this can be, it can be, it doesn't always have to be, but it can be a useful bridge or a door that you can open in a conversation with somebody who maybe has seen it and say, hey, did you know there were some kind of interesting Christian themes in the movie? So it can be a bridge or a window to talk about the gospel with other people who've maybe seen it and liked it and found it appealing for whatever reason they may have enjoyed the movie.
Always difficult, you know, when you're reviewing something, a mystery book or a movie in this case, how much of the plot and its line do you give away so you don't spoil it for somebody that hasn't? But what can you tell us? I was kind of awestruck by the way this movie starts off. Tell us a little bit about that and what maybe you took away from that.
Certainly. Well, I think the interesting thing is that it starts off like a lot of fairy tales with a magical world, sort of a, you know, knights and kings and queens kind of kingdom, your typical sort of fairy tale land, which Disney has done a lot of, you know, a lot of different ways and a lot of different stories.
Yeah, the whole Magic Kingdom, when you go to their theme parks, is kind of oriented around that big, beautiful castle structure,
exactly.
You know.
Everything is built around Sleeping Beauty's castle.
Yeah,
It's a main focal point. It's kind of like when you go to, like the seminary in Fort Wayne, I'm thinking, for example, that everything's built around the chapel. You can see it from any point on campus. And, you know, the tower at St. Louis, much of the similar kind of thing.
Sure.
You know, I think the Christian faith works the same way in a lot of respects. We'll kind of get to that later. But that's the setting of it. And as it starts off, the oldest daughter, her name is Elsa, and there's a younger daughter named Anna, or Anna, I think they pronounce it in the movie. At any rate, the two of them enjoy playing wonderfully, as young siblings often do. They don't show any of the sibling rivalry, which is nice.
Yeah, they don't show any of the real life between the two sisters, do
right,
they?
Right.
Yeah.
But you know, they get a good glimpse of how they enjoyed playing it. And Elsa has these magical powers, another kind of standard, maybe ingredient, you would call it, in fairy tales or fairy stories. And so she has this magical power that she can, in a way, I guess, summon or call forth or use. Her magical power can bring ice and snow. So the scene they show in the beginning of the movie is building a snowman together, and that snowman comes out later in the movie, too, in some rather fun and interesting, rather important ways. And Anna ends up getting hit by the snow as it's kind of shooting from Elsa's fingers, and it ends up hitting her. And in hitting her, she starts getting cold, and they take her to some trolls to try to help. Basically, they're kind of like the medicine men of this magical realm known as Arendelle. And so they end up fixing her, providing a cure of sorts, but giving a stern warning to the parents, the king and the queen, that really ends up being taken into effect of seclusion. So Elsa, the girl with the magical powers, is secluded and really kept away from her younger sister. And that kind of ensues throughout their entire upbringing. And the distance between the two increases, and that kind of creates some of the conflict and tension that comes out later in the movie, too.
Yeah, this magic that Elsa, the older sister, has to kind of bring not the greatest thing upon her sister or the kingdom or the area of kind of freezing it, where we kind of get the whole theme for the movie. Do you see any theological meaning in that?
I think the one thing that's apparent in the movie, and it does touch on what we would say maybe kind of coming from a first article gifts kind of idea, is that this ability to create snow and ice at kind of at her fingertips that is given to Elsa, it does appear to be a gift of some kind. The movie never really goes into explaining how it gets there, and that's fine. They don't really need to. This is kind of how life works in a magical world. Things like this happen. It's almost expected. So they don't go into explaining it, but they do make it seem like, okay, this is a gift. And the idea then with the gift is that it can be used both selflessly for others' enjoyment, which is really what it ends up being done in the first place when her and Anna are playing as children. It's used for enjoyment and for the betterment of their life together and the kind of relationship building, bonding, all of that. And then later it becomes a selfish thing where she withdraws from not only her family, especially after her parents' death, but she withdraws from her sister and really secludes herself in a high mountain. She builds an ice palace even unto herself and uses the gift selfishly. In fact, even doesn't use it at all as a result of the abuse or the misuse of it because she couldn't quite learn how to use the gift properly. So I think there's a little bit of a correspondence there in terms of how we use God's gifts as his creatures. The gifts themselves aren't always the problem. It's us, the sinful people, that use them and get a hold of them and then either abuse them or use them properly for the benefit of others.
That's well stated, Sam. All gifts of God are so amazing, but it's when we misuse them for our own selfish needs or I was thinking it seemed like Elsa would really use this gift of freezing everything when she got mad,
right?
Or scared too. And so that happens as well. And, we think of great gifts of our loving God, sex, music, nuclear power, and used in a great way for humanity. They're wonderful gifts, but used spitefully and selfishly, as you were saying, all kinds of troubles.
Yeah, you can really just run down the Ten Commandments, which you did a little bit in part there, and see how each of these things, that really God is giving us a protection by saying, thou shalt and thou shalt not. He's protecting certain gifts that he's giving to us. The first table of the law is the gift of himself in his divine, Trinitarian being, and also especially in the person and work of Christ. And then in the second table of the law, we see that gift of our neighbor, and both us to the neighbor and our neighbor's involvement with us, both of which, again, all those gifts you can kind of lay down and see how God is protecting us and giving us certain things along with those commands. And, what a really horrible mess things turn into when we take God's gifts and both ignore the giver and abuse the gift or turn it into an idol, kind of like Romans 1 discusses.
And so what's maybe a great interface with this whole idea of the gift and its being used in a playful, lovingly way with her sister Anna, and then in an abused way that affects so many in this animated world, is that the story kind of develops that the younger sister is really trying to save or redeem her older sister from this terrible predicament that she's in, and. What kind of got me, even though obstinate rejection and even standoffishness that her older sister would had, the younger one perseveres.
Yeah, and she never even gives up on her sister either, even after, like you said, continual rejection and just outright stubbornness from Elsa. Anna never gives up on her elder sister. Even just in the way that she treats her sister is, I think, a good... kind of a good picture of Christ's treatment and the favor of God, as we say in the scriptures, his attitude and position towards us, his stubborn, obstinate, always rebellious people.
So there's a wonderful point of contact we could use with younger people, others that are familiar with the movie, that God, does he ever give up on people that continue to hold him at arm's distance and even treat him miserably?
Yeah, that's one of the great comforting things about the gospel is that we may we may give up on God, and as Christians even, we may give up on other people and think, well, maybe they're too far gone. There's no way that God can rescue them from whatever maybe deep pit they've dug themselves into. Maybe it's whatever, a particular problem, sin, way of life, whatever. Maybe it's just the ravages of unbelief. But there's never this too far gone idea in God's ideas or in God's way of thinking. When we look in the scriptures, there's a great old poem called The Hound of Heaven, where God is depicted as this dog who continually chases and hounds people until he finally captures them. There was a great image of that in C.S. Lewis's book, The Horse and His Boy, where Aslan is chasing one of the young characters in the book, and even to the point of, you know, kind of tearing with his claws at the flesh, just as a reminder that there's somebody else there that's after you, but in a gracious way, of course.
And you're so right, Sam, that people see that in their life experiences, that God seems to pursue people and never let up, and he can even use us to continually to let them know that God, like you were saying there in Aslan and Anna in this film, seemed against all treatment, against all odds, they continue to love them and pursue them, and would love them to come back into the family of God. And so our Lord Jesus, he always seems to be like that. And sometimes, you know, he allows people to get into situations that look like they're impossible, no way out. And we know that's when God can work, not magic, but he can work his very best. And the Bible seems to describe that, doesn't it?
At every turn and twist, it seems like. This is another point of contact with the realm of Narnia and C.S. Lewis, where when Aslan dies, and you know they talk about the deep magic, and it's kind of like the law. The witch has this power over Narnia and requires the blood of the traitor. And instead, Aslan lays down his life and then says, well, there's a deeper magic. There's something that she didn't quite understand, and it's this relentless chasing of the gospel that Aslan brings. It's not unlike the prodigal son, or the parable of the prodigal son, which is actually the prodigal father, because he's the one that's reckless in his love for his two sons, both of whom end up, you know, leaving him, and one of whom comes back by God's grace. And that's really the great picture of Christ's salvation that we see in Jesus' own parables, too.
It reminded me, Sam, that last week we had a guest on. I'm not able to remember exactly who it was, but was talking about a rough time in their life. And when the phrase that stuck in my cranium was this one, that when I seemed to be at the end of my rope, there at the end of the rope was Jesus Christ for me. I love that.
A good way of grasping onto what is the gospel? How good of news is this? It's that good, even better. There was a Higher Things article I read many years ago. It was a play between John Calvin, Luther, and another Reformation. I think maybe it was Ulrich Zwingli, on talking about how they were doing a game show, and the idea was, who are they gonna? What's the starting point? Who's gonna win? How do you need to solve these particular challenges? And at the end, it ended up being Luther tossed his ladder and all these different implements to try to get this challenge accomplished into a hole, and all the other guys said, "That's no way to start it. You're completely in need of rescue. There's no good thing about you." And he said, "That's exactly it. That's where I'm supposed to start."
Yeah, you've hit on exactly where you're supposed to begin. Just with a few minutes before we have to take our first break. I don't know if you heard this, but I did in trying to research what some people had reacted to this film Frozen, Sam. It was said of the animator Mark Henn, who worked on this film, that he agreed that the film had a Christian message, mm-hmm. but not a blatant one. What do you think of that statement? If it's true that the chief animator said, "Yeah, there's Christian significance in here, but not blatant ones."
Yeah, I think some of the subtle things we've already discussed, at least in part, the idea of of a curse being undone, even from the beginning, even though the snow and the ice magical, again, that gift that Elsa has comes back later in the film in a larger way, giving it the frozen character of the world. But even at the beginning, there is this idea of, okay, there's a curse and there's a cure. I think that is a little more of a latent, subtle kind of, you know, at least an analogy to the Christian truth of good versus evil, and you know, sin and death and redemption. Not to mention the just the character or the qualities and characteristics that Anna has as a character in herself, displaying a lot of these similar kinds of things to what we would say in literature would be a Christ figure kind of person. But I don't see how you could say it's implicit or subtle when you get to the end of the movie, which maybe we'll talk about here later on in the next segment. But that seems to be, that's what hit me on the head when I was watching it. It seems to me that was a really obvious Christian connection. And maybe not so obvious to people who hadn't read the Gospels, but to people who have, or to people who've seen other stories like the Chronicles of Narnia or other kind of redemption stories, it seemed to me a really big point.
You know, also I was going to bring up and see what you thought about this, that, and we can talk about this a little later on also, that there were two lovers for Anna, and you know, they had different kind of motivations and different kind of love for her.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And there's a lot of some good interplay on just, you know, human relationships in one, but on what love is, and I think there are some helpful things there for Christians to learn from that segment of the movie, too.
And, you know, I was thinking that Jesus just flat out calls Satan the father of lies, the father of deceit. And in the movie, this one character seems to be just like that. Starts out to be such a fine-looking individual with wonderful traits and all the best in mind for little Anna. And then the truth comes out, and nobody likes the character, you know?
Yeah, he turns out to be a real rotten villain.
Yeah, and I thought, boy, this is hedging upon what the evil one's really MO is to start out really, I'm all for you, an angel of light, and yep, have the best, and I have your best interest at mind, you know, like when Satan says, hey, let me save you from God because he has some ulterior motives that are not healthy for you. Let me tell you about them.
Yep.
And they turn out to be nothing but deceit.
Yeah, like that old song, Devil in a Blue Dress kind of thing. It's much easier for the devil to pass himself as something that's more attractive, even seductive. It gets to that kind of language, I think, and that depiction is helpful for us to see what is, you know, like in the garden, what is attractive, what is pleasing to the eye, you know, what is desiring to make one wise. Those kinds of things are far easier for the devil to pass off than the really obvious, you know, horns and pitchfork kind of imagery that we commonly associate.
Absolutely. And so, you know, if a person would succumb to that kind of thing, the devil will use that too, but his more useful deceit is to come as something, as you said, that's more grandeur, more pure, seems more beautiful, more absolutely right on with its motivations. And then you discover when his fangs are too far into you, not really what it's about.
Right. And usually it centers around that thing we were talking about earlier in the idea of God's gifts of creation, where the devil will take those things that are good and are pleasing in God's sight and twist them and turn them inwardly to us and upon us, and thereby the gift turns into an idol, and something that is intended and given by God for his praise and glory ends up doing the opposite.
So whether you've saw this wonderful movie Frozen yet, come back in a little bit. We're going to discuss more of this with Pastor Sam Schulteis from California, and we're going to look at where the Christian is, and you can call us 314-821-0850, 1-800-730-2727, or KFUO at KFUO.org on the email. We'll be right back. You're listening to Cross Defense.
Hi, I'm Andy Bates. Join me for the next Faith and Family, where we'll talk with experts and everyday people about topics pertinent to faithful family life. Listen to Faith and Family Live weekdays at 11 on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news, underwritten by Concordia University, Wisconsin.
serving seniors wherever they call home. That's Lutheran Senior Services Home Health. For those who need to regain independence after an injury, illness, or decline in health or ability, Lutheran Senior Services Home Health can arrange for a variety of skilled services that will help older adults recover where they feel most comfortable, at home. Doctor's referral required, Medicare certified. Lutheran Senior Services Home Health. Learn more at lssliving.org.
Facebook is a great way to keep up with programming and get a behind-the-scenes glimpse into the broadcast day of KFUO Radio. This is where you'll find the inside scoop on programming and show links, photos, videos, and get details of upcoming events. And it's the place where you can connect with us and other listeners. And it's just so easy. Go to Facebook on your computer or smart device, put KFUO into the search box, select our page, and like us today. And oh yes, it's totally free. So what are you waiting for?
Hello, I'm Rod Zwanitzer, Director of Broadcast for KFUO. We totally depend on the gracious supporters who want this gospel voice to continue and expand as the messenger of good news of Christ. A wonderful part of this support is our underwriters, an ever-increasing number, and so we ask you to find out who they are by checking them out on our website or as you hear them here on KFUO. Write, call, or tell them how much you appreciate their support of Worldwide KFUO.
Aerialist Nick Walenda has completed a tightrope walk inside the Georgia Dome, cheered on by more than 30,000 people at a Christian music festival as he carefully moved more than 100 feet above the field without a harness or safety net. The high wire act took place during the Winter Jam tour featuring New Song, the Newsboys, and other Christian bands. New Song's Matt Butler says before the show,
he prayed with us and prayed for us, and we prayed for him, and then we go on stage, and next thing you know, he's up on the wire, and we're like, all right, Lord, we brought him here to do this, so just protect him.
Well, Walenda was wearing a microphone and stopped midway across to share his faith with the audience.
He talked about hard work and discipline and paralleled that with his life with Christ and the amount of time he spends in the Word. And the closer he gets to God, the more faith and confidence he has in what he does. And all the while, he's up on this wire and he's just sharing about his faith, talking about the Lord.
Winter Jam continues with concerts across the country through March, but Saturday was Walenda's only scheduled appearance. I'm Steve Coleman.
Welcome back to Cross Defense. Rod Zwanitzer here, talking with Pastor Sam Schultheis from California. That's one of the major songs within the movie. I heard it was nominated for an Oscar. This is the older sister, Elsa. And at one point in that song, Sam, she cries out, "No right, no wrong, no rules for me, I'm free." That sounds like kind of a an American universal belief, right?
Yeah, it's really... That song, it comes at a rather interesting, it's such an irony that it's a really well-sung song, and it's beautiful, but the words to it are rather tragic because she's, in a sense, she's embracing her selfishness and her willingness to withdraw and completely seclude herself from her family, her country, who needs her. I mean, she's the queen, and she's left her position, she's left her vocation that she was, you know, was given and handed down from her family. And she's celebrating, in a sense, her idolatry of sorts. It's a rather odd song. That's the song that Zoe loves running around the house singing, which is really funny, just because she picks up the "Let It Go" famous chorus there.
Yeah, that'd be an easy one for any of us to pick up and kind of go on. But as you're right, it's kind of self-centered and almost says, hey, if it doesn't really harm anybody, and like she says, I'm into the cold anyway, so
right.
I'm free. And we realize even spiritually and biblically, Sam, that's a lie, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, Luther wrote that famous essay and treatise on the bondage of the will that... we're free in matters of earthly things, you know, what kind of socks we wear or carpet you might choose for your new home or, you know, what sort of movie to go see or whatever it is. But in terms of spiritual things, in terms of, you know, salvation and our status before God, freedom is the farthest thing from it. We're actually in bondage to slavery. We need rescue. We need deliverance and redemption. We need somebody like Christ to come from outside of us and to release the captives and to heal our deadly mortal wounds of sin and to, you know, then drown our sinful human nature.
It's always interesting too that what a person puts out there to the rest of the world, like Elsa does, that hey, I'm really into this frozen state. Might not be true and good for her or her loved ones, but they have a hard time coming out of it and admitting it.
Yeah,
and
you can see what havoc it wreaks on the kingdom of Arendelle as they kind of go back and forth between her singing her songs up in the mountains, in her new ice palace. And then you look down, they show a couple of glimpses down below in the town, and yeah, this rather villainous character, as he turns out to be Hans, comes and he starts really taking up, setting up shop and claiming to be the one in charge because Anna went to go chase after her sister and to go to try to rescue her, and the town's frozen, and people from all over different countries were there to celebrate the queen's coronation. Now they're stuck, and things quickly unravel and fall apart and become rather tangled. The other thing that Elsa's song shows there is that pervading idea in our culture, especially in America today, of this no right or wrong, this very postmodern idea that objective truth is not, isn't part of our vocabulary. You know, whatever's true for you is true for you, and I have my own truth and this and that, which is, of course, deeply ironic, too, because that in itself is an objective, rather dogmatic statement, but that usually doesn't quite catch on right away in a discussion.
You know, kind of reminded me at that point, Sam, I think I, like you, am just a real lover of the Chronicles of Narnia, when in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there's that great line, it's always winter, but there's never Christmas.
Yep. Yeah, when I saw the previews for the movie, that was the first thing that came to my mind. I thought, ooh, somebody's been reading the Chronicles of Narnia and made a Disney movie similar to it. There were some overlapping points, not as much as I had thought initially when I saw the previews, but I wasn't disappointed in that regard either, I think, because there was clearly that, if not intentional, similarity. It was definitely something that was at least unintentional or at least very subtle and similar.
Yeah. And this younger sister who is then pursuing a possible rescue, a release for her entrapped sister in this frozen world, becomes really the focus of the rest of the movie, and I know we're just kind of wrapped up in it, and they did a nice job, I think, of turning at subtle points where you thought, like as you were saying, Hans is going to be the one to really help out, and then there's another subtle shift away from Hans, and you're wondering what's going to happen, right?
Yeah, you really left. It's just a good story told in general, I think. The folks there at Disney, I know one of the names that struck out on the screen when the credits were rolling through was John Lasseter, and he was involved in a lot of the famous Pixar-Disney combination movies, the Toy Stories and that kind of thing. And I know his story craft and story writing was a major part of this, I'm sure. I'm just guessing anyway, but good storytelling, good twists and turns, things that move the plot along that help you. And you expect this character Hans to be sort of the play the knight in shining armor thing. But what he ends up doing is playing on Anna's naivete. Not that that was any fault of her own. She shouldn't be blamed for that. I think in the movie, that's you know, he takes advantage of her and of her innocence in a way, because that's what it was. And then he ends up trying to, you know, further his own selfish, what we would say sinful whims in exercising control and power, which is the complete opposite of what Anna wanted, of course. Anna wanted, you know, love and giving of self to another person and that kind of thing. And Hans had his own agenda in mind, which is the polar opposite of the other male, ended up being the other male romantic figure, and the rather unlikely one of Christoph, the ice-blocking, oh, kind of rough-and-tumbled mountain man sort of guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and what a great bit of artwork were done on him. I remember just because he was kind of larger than life in certain picture scenes, and just great animation and artwork done on him.
Yeah. And good comedy too. They had a lot of just good funny, you know, some good humorous points that between no matter what age you're at, just some funny stuff.
Yeah, when they run into kind of like the general store out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And both he and Anna are trying to purchase things. That's just some hilarious back and forth comedy, as you say. If a person, I think, walks away from this, and even if they don't have a Christian bent or even a religious bent, it seems like that the overwhelming ending and meaning of this is good always prevails over evil in the end.
Right. Yeah, and that is also coupled with, I think, the two other ideas that we've been talking about, this idea of love and sacrifice, and those really fit together well in this story, just as a self-contained movie and as a narrative itself, that the triumph of good over evil happens precisely because you have this undying, unconditional love, and as a result of that, you also have Anna's sacrifice, which is done out of love for her sister. And for, you would probably have to say, well, for her entire, for the kingdom too, because she wasn't doing it just for herself or for her sister. The whole kingdom was locked in this eternal winter, and so it was a rescue for everybody.
Well put. And I know, Sam, that the good apologist that you are, and Christian pastor and teacher, and just believer, that we look for jumping off points. Points of connection with somebody that might not be in the Christian fold yet, which ones do you really see as good ones to explore with somebody that maybe has seen this Disney film Frozen, and you'd like to take them, from that into a Christian perspective?
Yeah, I think we've touched on a few of the few initial things already. The idea of gift in God's creation, this idea of love, certainly begins as sort of a seed in the beginning of the movie, and then it blossoms and grows throughout the entire movie. I think if you want to take the person in a conversation to the central part of the Christian faith, which is always a good place to go in a discussion, if you have the classic question, if you have 5 minutes with somebody on a train or an airplane or wherever it is, what are you going to tell them? What are you going to talk about with them about the Christian faith? You could go a lot of places. The best thing is probably to go right to the central event of the Christian faith, which is Jesus' death and resurrection. So in the movie, I think you can use that if that's going to be your bridge or your window or your connecting point in a conversation. Go to the central part of the movie, which actually comes at the end with this love and sacrifice of Anna, the younger sister, on behalf of her older sister and the kingdom of Arendelle as well, where she physically puts her life in the way of Hans's sword, and at the same time is being cursed by yet another snow ice magic incident that has happened previously, several scenes before, and so she is immediately frozen solid as the sword comes down, and she puts herself, a dead person, in the way of the sword, so to save her sister and Arendelle, although she didn't really know she was doing that, but that's when it ended up happening. It ended up unlocking the eternal winter. It ended up abolishing the curse.
Yeah, for the entire community and the known world in that little animated sense. Is there not only that sacrificial death, is there any resurrection connection there?
Oh, absolutely. It's right on the flip side, because you see in the movie they did a beautiful job of animating this, kind of like they did in Beauty and the Beast, which I got to watch a lot with my younger sister when she was growing up because she adored that movie. You know, at the end you have this, you know, this big mangy beast and he dies, and then, you know, the rose starts to fall apart and then this transformation happens. Well, in Frozen, much a similar thing happens. Almost simultaneously these things happen. Anna gets frozen, the sword comes down on her, and then after that you see the ice starting to crack. And the troll's prophecy, or the words of the troll, come true, and, you know, in saying that an act of true love is what's going to be the thing that abolishes the curse. And up until that point, you're thinking it has to be some kind of romantic thing. You know, maybe it's Hans, which doesn't pan out. Maybe it's Kristoff, which looks likely, but, you know, then the viewer realizes quickly, no, it's not going to be Hans, because Anna throws herself into the position of the substitute. And then after that, the ice starts to crack and everything melts, and springtime takes over, which comes about beautifully in the Chronicles of Narnia, but it's a biblical image, too, and that is the new creation, the curse being thrown back, and you know, creation's groaning, like Paul talks about in Romans, coming to an end.
Yeah, and that comes through very strongly, and so if a person would really want to go to write it to the dynamite, the explosive power that God uses to save all of us, you would want to take them right there.
Yeah, I think so. Go right for the central point. Go right for the death and resurrection scene. I mean, in the movie, that's definitely it, and in the Gospels, think about how much time the Gospel writers spend on Holy Week, and then the moments and days and weeks after it in Jesus' resurrection. Some of them more than others. I mean, like John and Luke spend more time than Mark, for example, but they all spend a majority of the time on that big central event of Christ's life and his sacrifice for the world. And so what a nice glimpse again of the gospel it is to see that in a movie.
You know, Sam, I know you're into this more than I am because I consider myself kind of movie illiterate. I don't take in a lot of movies, but every now and then I see something that kind of fascinates me. And when I was in the parish, I used to love to, in confirmation class and youth group, and even for adults, find some movies and that I thought had some Christian connection. And play them for people and just talk about them.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful thing to do.
We even had a movie night for a while, and we would do that, and we got into some great stuff. And the one that just is for an example that I used to really love, and I think the kids, it took them a lot of while, 7th and 8th graders, you know, a tough crowd anyway. But I used to love the Chariots of Fire.
Oh, sure.
And this dramatic contrast between the Christian and the Jewish track stars.
Yeah.
And how the Olympics and gold medals even affected these two individuals, and slow developing, and you know, you have to be careful there, and kids. But if you were going to use this movie, Frozen, what would you be your thoughts on what kind of age groups that you might show this to, and how you might develop that?
Great question. I think a couple of different ways you could do it. I know here at Redeemer, one of the things our congregation does every year. Our Sunday school hosts what we call a drive-in movie night, and it's the youth group caters all, brings all the food while the kids are busy in the fellowship hall making cardboard box cars, basically anything, really any vehicle they want. We had some kid build a tank and a submarine before, too, so it's not limited to automobiles. But they build their vehicles, they sit in them, and then they watch a movie projected up on a screen, and we serve them dinner and snacks.
Sounds
and
fun.
And yeah, I think a setting like that is great because you get an opportunity for the families to come together, the really kind of a multi-generation activity. So I think that's good.
And this would be really good for families, as you already said, between yourself
Definitely. And
Zoe and that. So good family flick here.
Yeah, I think so. You could watch it together with the families. You could watch it, you know, with different segments of, you know, like certain ages of Sunday school and even, I think, some youth groups, depending on, you know, the age and maturity of the kids. Some of them might think it's a little beneath them, but I'm sure a lot of them would probably secretly enjoy it anyway if they weren't too, you know, weren't too concerned about their public image. Just don't tell any of their friends on Facebook they were watching it.
Yeah, when you get to be an adult like us, you just don't really care. You know,
that's
say,
right.
Hey, yeah, I liked the movie and
cool.
I liked the music.
That's right.
Yeah.
At some point, you just have to embrace being a big nerd, and that's okay.
But as we're talking here, Sam, I think we've exposed that there's a lot of connections with theology in Frozen.
Yeah, no doubt there is. I think to some degree there's a lot more of those subtle things like the Disney official, and I had read that too. Thought that was fascinating because I had seen some of these ideas before that came out and was glad to see that I wasn't just sort of reading things into it. That can happen. We have to be aware of that, of course. But there's also some really big, explicit, rather glaring things and examples, the chief one being, again, kind of the height and climax of the movie with that sacrifice and resurrection and the unthawing of creation.
Yeah, and I don't know any significance of the snowman, and he does a great song. I saw the interview with the actor's voice that was on it. He really talked about he enjoyed for once being able to do a song, and he thought he pulled it off really good. And it was good.
He was a fun character too, kind of a little bit more of that lighthearted comedic relief that is just a part of, you know, Disney usually does that part pretty well.
And the moose, sidekick to the mountain man.
Yeah, he was probably my favorite. The snowman was good and all, but Sven the reindeer was definitely my favorite as far as the comedy sort of funny things go.
And then, you know, Elsa kind of has the feel for me, not quite even pushing over there, but the witch in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, there is that. I think there's a subtle similarity there. It'd be fun to talk to the writers and see if they intended that similarity or that connection to be there. I mean, for one who's read it, read the Chronicles of Narnia multiple times, it really seems unavoidable because it's such a dominant theme in that first book that Lewis wrote of Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, where the world of Narnia is locked in this curse, and that this curse is, like we mentioned before, it's always winter but never Christmas, which is a dreadful thing because, I mean, winter is hard enough by itself, but at least when you get Christmas, you get this joy of Christ's incarnation breaking into the world. Lewis describes it elsewhere as an invasion. Right, the rightful king has landed in his territory, and he's come to take back the world and us, his people, that are in it, and so he calls us then to participate in this this act of sabotage. That's what we do when we go to church. We're like the secret people listening in our radios in the closets and attics of our of our homes and everything, and Christ comes in and breaks in and ushers in the new creation by his death and resurrection.
I really like that that sense you were talking about of the breaking through of Aslan in the Narnia thing, and then there's a breaking through in Frozen as well, and that's a great line because, you know, Jesus, that was so prevalent when he first started preaching and teaching. You know, the kingdom of God is upon you.
Right. Yeah. The reign of heaven. Right. This is it's an active, ongoing thing. It's well, like in the Chronicles of Narnia again, when the beavers and the children are talking, the classic line and phrase is, Aslan is on the move again. And you can see the same thing happening in the Gospels right from the get-go. You know, like take John, for example. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh, and then he became flesh and dwelt among us. And the Christ, the Messiah, Jesus is on the move. And the Gospel then just explodes from there. As far as Christ coming in, like in Luke, where he quotes Isaiah in, you know, releasing the captives from their bondage to slavery and proclaiming the year of the Lord's favor, and the dead walking and raising and all these things, you know, absolutely miraculous things. But this is what comes when Christ brings an end to the eternal winter of sin, because that's what it is too. It's that analogous thing to the curse of sin and death that were brought about by not the white witch, but by Satan. And by the fall into sin back in Genesis.
And you know what impresses me there, Sam, is just the other day it impacted me that I said I hadn't thought of that in a long time, that in those places where Christianity really got its base, Northern Africa, mm-hmm. and around in there, and it seemed like it was overtaken by all kinds of forces. Christianity is making a big return.
Yeah.
And it's almost like that it's invading again in new generations. And you get that kind of in Frozen, this back and forth thawing and freezing. And that seems to fit almost with the history of God's plan of salvation.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's some good parallels that we can see that in history, that it looks like, you know, one place may be completely swallowed up and gone forever, off into the darkness kind of thing. But like we mentioned earlier, Christ doesn't give up on people as easily as we perhaps do. And places that once looked to be dry and arid will once again become, become a place where his word goes out and is sown and doesn't return to him void or empty, but does what he promises.
It is very special, too, that these talented people who do all this wonderful animation and such can give us this kind of a movie that we as believers and as the church can actually use apologetically and for just our enjoyment and share with everyone. And, we start talking about good gifts and bad gifts and used profitably for the furtherance of Christ's kingdom and not. And so amazing that we have these great gifts of animation and all the rest of movie making that delights us so much to be able to share with our own kids. How special for you, maybe you can talk just a little bit about that at the end, for you and Zoe, your young daughter, to go and share a fun movie that just isn't for fun.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I think one of the greatest things about the Lutheran Reformation was that Luther brought back to the church this idea of vocation and how God serves us through vocation of others. And I think, especially here in America, we were blessed with more leisure time than other places in the world. But part of that is a good thing in that we have an opportunity to have enjoyment from things, and, you know, whether it's books or movies and things like that. Luther often commented that he didn't want somebody that was, a Christian shoemaker, I think is one of his, these paraphrased quotes goes, to put a little cross on each of their shoes, but just to make good shoes. And in doing that, in making good shoes, they were doing a good service unto others and serving people. I think we can, by extension, make the same comment about people who make good movies today, that they're doing a good thing for other people in showing, even if it's not any particular glimpse of Christianity, maybe it's a particular moral or some kind of truism sort of thing. And entertainment in itself is also not entirely bad either, provided it's focusing us on the right and proper things. So that idea of the arts and of the beauty and of really showcasing God's handiwork, even when it's not recognized by the makers of the film that it is such, it still is that.
You know, when we set out, Sam, to kind of do this new program lineup and cross defense for apologetics is a big part of that. We also wanted to do exactly what you're talking about with vocation, culture and Christianity is the program on Wednesdays.
Yeah.
And we try to have all kinds of people on, from musicians to artists to poets, and movie makers would be a great one too, to talk to them about how they see they can use that gift of God for the furtherance of the kingdom. And it can be subtle at times and still
definitely
be magnificent and powerful as people like Tolkien and C.S. Lewis exemplified. And now we've got this case in our own time. So great stuff. And we, thank God for all them, and we thank God for you. And when you get another good movie or such that you like to come on, we'd love to have you back on.
Well, thank you. Always a pleasure to come on and talk about some of my favorite things, Christianity and apologetics and the defense of the faith and good stories as well, whether it's on film or book, always happy to do so.
Let's do it again. And so God's blessings go with you, Sam. Next Monday on Cross Defense, Making the Case for Christianity, great new collection of essays, by editor, one of the editors, Adam Francisco, will join us. Join us then, 2 p.m. next Monday for Cross Defense.